Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 31, where we're talking Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Well, and not just Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but all of the Planet of the Apes, maybe minus the Tim Burton, Mark Wahlberg one. But we take a look at the franchise, and it's really great because of that, I have Ben Avery on, who is a huge Planet of the Apes fan. We bring up the word expert more than once, even though he denies it, but he's from the Strangers and Aliens podcast. Some of you know that I've had the privilege to guest over there. He also does the Welcome to Level 7 podcast and is launching the Comic Book Time Machine podcast. Needless to say, he's a podcast master. Also, for the second time, joining us is Wade Bearden. He has wadebearden.com, where he blogs about God, life, and arts. He also is on the Christ and Pop Culture podcast every Friday. So if you enjoy that podcast, make sure you catch him on that. We talk, like I said, we talk about the franchise, Planet of the Apes, just our love for it, some of the missteps we think it's made, and just this new movie that has come out on the back of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, kind of the surprise hit that it was. This new one's beautiful. There's talk that it's the movie of the summer. Some say the movie of the year. It's got themes of family, violence, there's peacemakers, forgiveness, all of these thoughts on humanity, just like all the other Planet of the Apes films. So we take a look at all that. So if you're interested in that at all, I think you'll enjoy this one. Here it is, episode 31, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and Tribalism. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. I don't want to take too much credit, you know, but I'll take as much as I possibly can. For you being a mogul. Ben was podcasting long before I was, so I can't take any of that credit, so I take it where I can take it.
Oh, man. And you guys, I appreciate being on. I was so excited when y'all asked me to do Captain America. It was fun, and I enjoy talking about films.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's why we're all here. There's so many things I want to talk about that's not even about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I kind of wanted to kind of hop right in, even though we typically have like a pre-conversation. So, I mean, for anyone who's listening, we are going to be talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is the sequel to the reboot Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And it just takes the next step in Caesar's journey. And we're probably going to get into all that. So I just wanted to kind of make sure that people knew they were listening to the right episode. Hopefully they downloaded it correctly. And that I am joined by Ben and Wade. And like I said, one of the questions I hinted at just a couple minutes ago, and I got to talk to Ben just a little bit about, and I would probably already know the answer to if I had taken the time to either be a subscriber to Christ and Pop Culture or to have made time for Ben for the Strangers and Aliens podcast that I think you guys just put it out last week on basically the history of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it just kind of covers the franchise.
So
from the book to Dawn, we didn't talk much about Dawn. In fact, at the end of the podcast, I said I'll be talking about Dawn of the Planet of the Apes on Real World Theology. So I'm probably skipping our Dawn of the Planet of the Apes review episode. I just probably won't do it since I'm doing it here.
Oh nice. Man. See, now I feel even more special and sad that I have not listened to that yet. Well, okay. So what I typically do, guys, is I usually let whoever is on Skype answer any question first. But this is my first all Skype guest episode. Nice. So because of that, you guys can have you can flip a coin, you can have some kind of internet fist fight, but I want to know what your experience is with the Planet of the Apes franchise before we even get into any particular movie.
Ben, I think you need to take this one first because you're like an expert.
I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I am a big fan. definitely. And I've read a few books, and I've watched all the movies multiple times. So my experience with it goes back to when I was just a wee little lad, though, watching Saturday afternoon movies, and when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. And I remember watching Battle for Planet of the Apes, although I couldn't have told you what the name of it was. Mm-hmm. But watching that movie and not knowing what it was until later on, when I actually had a chance to realize, oh, there's 5 of these movies, and this happens in this one, this happens in that one. But there is a – I don't know how much into spoilers you want to go with some of these things.
With the old ones?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
They've been really long time.
Yeah, I was going to say.
If you don't know what happens, it's kind of your fault. You know, it's 40 years old.
Well, and I'll say this too. We're going to spoil Dawn, and we're going to spoil Dawn from the beginning. I mean, if you're listening to this, we're talking about the entire themes of the movie. So at some point, we're going to spoil everything that happens. And we don't really have – since our conversation is more kind of fluid instead of structured, much to the chagrin of some people we could actually spoil the movie sooner than later, so I don't want to promise anybody we're not going to spoil it before a certain point. So with that said, anything in the, like, what is it, 40, almost 45 year?
Yeah, it's 68.
So, you got like 45 years of Planet of the Apes history. Everything is on the table, so talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, whenever possible, I'll be vague. But with Battle for the Planet of the Apes, there's a scene that just really stuck out to me because it put a kid in peril. And when I say kid, I mean ape kid. But
kid.
It put an ape child in peril. And I'm just like, you know, he's climbing a tree and it's gorillas following him. And all the other gorillas are like chanting. And it's just crazy, freaky, weird. And then the child falls. Like, whoa, wait. And it really made an impression on me. But I watched a couple of those movies when I was very young. And then in junior high, I was able to catch a couple more. And then finally, it would have been in college where I was actually doing, you know, my sci-fi movie homework, you know, because I was going to film school. I was a communications major and I was writing a lot. And that's when I really I knew what happened in most movies. But this is when I sat down, watched them in order, and really got interested in just kind of the structure of this franchise, because it wasn't meant to be a franchise. And it was meant to stop being a franchise a couple times. And and then it kind of takes this dip in quality. And then it went on TV. And so, yeah, when the Planet of the Apes TV series came out on DVD, I don't know what year that would have been. But I bought it almost at full price. And I was just like, I'm buying that because how else am I going to see it? 2001. So right in time for Mark Wahlberg's movie. But I was just really getting into it, reading the books, and then Mark Wahlberg's movie came out, and I was like, yeah, oh, okay. Well. But I stayed a fan and I even bought that movie. You know, I had that on my shelf. I didn't buy the Blu-ray. Everything else I've done repeat buys on. You know, I bought it on DVD and then bought another copy of Planet of the Apes because it had extra commentaries on it, and then mm-hmm. I bought the Blu-ray series.
And you've watched all the commentaries?
No, not all of them, but most of them. I've, and it's been a long time since I've watched commentaries on them. I planned to this time around, but I was like, no, I'm just going to watch the movie and just enjoy it. And so I did, leading up to this release of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I did go back, rewatch all of them and most of the TV series, but not the animated series, but the live action. There was 14 episodes that they did of the live action series. So, but anyway, yeah, just over time I got more and more interested in it, and it's just an intriguing franchise. Some of the behind the scenes stuff, it's really interesting. It's just a franchise I really enjoy, and it's even the bad movies in this franchise say something. Mm-hmm. and that's something I appreciate about this franchise as well.
Is there anything in the franchise that you know exists that you have not consumed?
You mean the actual licensed franchise?
Yeah.
The comic book.
Okay.
I have not read the Marvel comic book from the early 70s.
You are slacking.
Yeah. I don't even know anymore. And I've not read the tie-in novels. Like, you know, they did some prequel novels for the Mark Wahlberg movie they did a prequel novel for this movie that I have not watched, or rather I haven't read. And they also did Boom Studios. I haven't touched the comic books that much, or the tie-in novels, but I did read the original novel, which was very enjoyable. I read it after I was a fan, and so I was coming back and reading it and just, oh, this is where it started. So,
wow.
So you are like 94% expert. You still have a little bit.
Again, I don't know if I would say expert, but enthusiast. How's that?
Well, however you want to define it, it's impressive. And Wade, okay, so where are you at?
I feel embarrassed right now to say. Well, I mean,
I thought you'd go first because of this.
I know. Well, okay, so I've watched the movies, right? I've seen all the movies, and as a kid, I remember they would come on like AMC, and they would have these weekends where they would just play all of them. And so I'd watch them. Sometimes I'd watch the whole thing. Sometimes I watch bits and pieces of them. And so I've seen all of them, and I've gone back and kind of studied and looked into them. But that's kind of the extent of my knowledge. Whenever I was growing up, I liked watching them, but I wouldn't say I was a huge fan. I was really confused when I first saw them, because at first you're thinking the Planet of the Apes. Okay, the apes are the bad people. They're the bad guys. The humans are the good guys. And as I started getting older, you know, it would really frustrate me because it doesn't ever, you know, humans don't ever take it back per se, the planet. And but as I got older, I began to realize, okay, this is trying to say something. And both groups have good and bad. It's trying to say something about the world. And that's what I really liked about Dawn, and we'll get into it, but there's really no good and bad group. There's just good and bad individuals. And so I liked the films, and I liked the commentary, the social commentary, the subtext of the films. And so it's a series that I can appreciate a little bit more now that I'm older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I would say that actually sounds a lot like my experience with the Planet of the Apes franchise. I've seen all the films, and actually, I had a chance to talk to Ben right before this, and I posted on Facebook, stuff like that. My wife Laura and I, who's sometimes on the show, she had never seen any of the Planet of the Apes movies. So we went back and watched from the beginning over the past, I'd say, month in preparation for this one. We watched all the five old movies, and because I care a lot about my wife, we skipped the Mark Wahlberg movie and just kind of watched the summary. And then she was happy after reading some of the summary and highlights that she did not spend her time watching that. And, you know, I was glad as well. And then we watched Rise, and I think it enriched my enjoyment of Rise, having gone back and seen kind of like where the franchise had been. But even the bad movies, I use, you know, air quotes, even the bad original five, or one of the whichever ones you consider bad, I still think they all have something to say.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're like I said, as far as movies go, some of them are a little boring. Some of them aren't very well done, but I feel like you could have like a 3-hour conversation on any of those movies because they're so rich with just theme.
And some of the badness comes from being almost kind of damned by the budget and damned by the time that they were made. You know, they're definitely a product of their time and a product of their budget. And
they're coming
out
every
year. Yeah, for a little while there.
Yeah, there's like 68, 70, 71, 72, 73. Like, there's really no time to write scripts. It's like, hey, let's just pull out a camera and go.
Well, that was the weird thing, because I thought as the series progressed, I thought it got better.
I like Escape from the Planet of the Apes. I really enjoyed that film. I thought that was a very well made film.
Well,
which is the third in the series. Yeah.
The third in the series. Yeah.
So, for anyone who doesn't know, it was Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes,
and battle for the Planet of the Apes. And one of the
prepositions.
Yes, yeah. a lot of ofs. So when we talk about good versus bad in the old films, like I was kind of wondering where you guys land on the spectrum, because I asked a couple people this and I never really got two of the same answer. Like, you know, what would you consider the worst of the first five, and what would you consider probably the best?
Well, go ahead.
Ben.
We're just going to trip over politeness now.
Yeah, I felt like the best of the old franchise was probably Planet of the Apes, but I did really like Escape from the Planet of the Apes. But Planet of the Apes is very iconic, so it's hard to say, you know, there's a better one than that. As for worst, I think Beneath the Planet of the Apes was not really was probably my least favorite out of all of them. Though the final one of the original battle for the Planet of the Apes was just, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of that. So, you know, between Battle and Beneath, so that would be the two and number five.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would have a similar answer for the best. I mean, Planet of the Apes is classic. It's iconic. It's a movie that you should watch. If you're into sci-fi and you haven't seen it, it's a movie you should go ahead and watch, because you're going to see where a lot of things came from. Yeah. You're going to see – I mean, it is one of those movies – well, 1968 was 2001 A Space Odyssey and Planet of the Apes, two movies that they're both G-rated but both definitely adult-themed.
Yeah.
And it kind of was a shift in sci-fi. And so from 68 until Star Wars came out, you had a lot of more adult-themed sci-fi movies that didn't just have to be shoot 'em up, bang-bang, space opera kind of thing. Star Wars, one episode we want to do for Strangers and Aliens is how Star Wars both destroyed and recreated sci-fi. You know,
yeah,
because after Star Wars, everything changed.
One.
But after, I would also say after Planet of the Apes in 2001, everything changed. And so they were able to make Soylent Green, and they were able to make The Omega Man, and they were able to, which are both Charlton Heston, and they were able to make Silent Running and some of those kind of things. But Planet of the Apes, classic, iconic. It's Charlton Heston, and so the movie is on his shoulders and he can carry it. And you're introduced to this world. Escape from Planet of the Apes is very fun, and it's kind of fun because it's a flip side where you have the apes, you know, the apes are now trapped in the world of it's all different, and it's a madhouse and they're put on trial. And it's a fun movie. It's a sweet movie. It's a funny movie. But just like every other Planet of the Apes movie, it ends really on a bitter, bitter note.
Yeah.
We can talk about that maybe in the future here. But Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, I also think is a really strong movie. There's some budget problems, and there's a lot of ape makeup, or rather masks, that definitely don't look very good in the daylight. And there's a lot of daylight. But but it's good. And if you have a chance, if you want to, I also recommend watching I don't know if they call it the director's cut or the extended cut, but it's the cut that got, this is the only PG Planet of the Apes movie in the first five. Originally was going to get an R rating because of the violence of the end battle. And it's very 70s violence, with gunshots and splatters of paint just flying, you know.
Yeah.
But there's also just a lot of Holocaust imagery in there, where they're piling up bodies and there's burning, you know, flames and everything like that. It's just very, very dark and not a happy ending at all. But those three, I would say, are the strongest. Beneath the Planet of the Apes, I still recommend, because it links Planet of the Apes to Escape from Planet of the Apes. But it drags in the middle so much.
It does.
Charlton Heston is in the first 5 or 10 minutes, and he's in the last 5 or 10 minutes. And when he's on the screen, there's good stuff. And there's weird stuff with the mutants, and there's weird stuff with them worshiping the Doomsday bomb.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's crazy and boring at the same time. I don't understand. Most bad movies that are crazy, you're like, well, at least I'm not bored. It might be bad, but I'm not bored.
Yeah.
And this is one where you're just like, what in the... I'm bored out of my mind, but this is just crazy, and I love crazy, but I'm bored. So, but I for the ending alone, that movie just has to, you almost have to sit through it for the ending alone.
Mm-hmm.
One time, sit through it one time, to get the full effect of that ending they throw at you. That big twist ending that every Planet of the Apes movie has, or should have, or should tries have. To have.
Tries well, I think to that have, was, maybe. I think that was part of the problem with Beneath, because Beneath, I think even though it was really wacky and crazy, it felt really, it was almost like a replay of Planet of the Apes with not Charlton Heston.
Yes.
Until right there at the end, and then it started kind of really having its own voice.
Again, consider the time, though, because the only way you could see Planet of the Apes was in the theaters, and then maybe on TV later on, although I don't think it was until the after Beneath the Planet of the Apes that it really caught on television. So you weren't watching these movies on home media. And back so to so to watch Beneath the Planet of the Apes, for it to be a retread of the first one, you might say, yeah, this looks kind of familiar, but it's probably been, you know, 2 years since you've seen that last one, if you saw it at all. Yeah, so it is. Yeah. It does play out kind of like a greatest hits, where it's like, okay, here. Oh, we need a good chase here. Oh, we need a scene where he realizes, you know, it's Earth. Oh, we need a scene where he meets the good, kind apes, you know.
Yeah.
But
it's like the 1970s version of previously on Planet of the Apes.
Exactly. Well, and you remember movies where they would actually play out the, you know, the first 3 minutes of the movie is showing you scenes from the previous movie, like Star Trek IV, you know, where it showed you all the scenes from Star Trek III, or the end of Star Trek III anyway. But Battle for Planet of the Apes, by far the worst. It's a 2-hour TV movie. It has a TV movie budget, it feels like. It actually had more of a budget. But this is where, after Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, where it's just really playing on these ideas of race, and there's riots and shootings and killings and all this stuff in the movie. They wanted to do a TV show, and I think they kind of said, well, we need to make a more kiddie version that parents can say, okay, oh, that's what you're seeing the TV show of. You know, when you turn on the TV on Friday night or whatever night it was on, Battle for the Planet of the Apes definitely feels like it feels TV. It feels small. It tries to be big, but it's not. The battle for the Planet of the Apes is really weak. It's not a fun battle to watch. But then it kind of leads up to, you know, the TV show that came on, I think, the next year, and where it's, you know, it's a 70s TV show. And, you know, so definitely Battle for Planet of the Apes, lowest of the five for me.
It reminded me of like some of the or the battle that was in Mad Max.
Yeah, but less energetic.
You know, but like way, you know. But I think what you said was actually probably perfect. But like the made for TV version of it.
Yeah.
I guess we all line up a lot more than I thought, because I was so incredibly bored in the middle of Beneath, that it was probably my least favorite, because even though the stuff in Battle was bad, I didn't almost fall asleep.
Things are happening so.
I mean, and I really like any time once they introduce like, or once Roddy McDowall really kind of had a central role, I thought all the Planet of the Apes movies kind of picked up a lot.
Him in Beneath. That wasn't even Roddy McDowall there. So, yeah.
Yeah, in Beneath, yeah. That's why, well, once again, Beneath, not very good. But Escape and Conquest, and even, like I said, I even think not get too much into like a complete breakdown of Battle, but, you know, for what that movie was kind of trying to do and the themes it was tackling, I think it was trying to tackle, I thought, you know, he carried most of that movie. But I like Planet a lot, but in kind of that, like, that reverence for an iconic film. Like, yeah. I felt like watching it, like, if I just watched it today trying to determine how much I liked it, I was like, the film's not, in my opinion, like, it's got pretty boring parts. It lingers for a long time, kind of like a, you know, late 60s sci-fi film would. It feels like a B movie. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, it is, but the just iconicness of the movie, the fact that it was like what made in 68 and we hadn't even been to the moon yet, and it was like depicting space travel and all these things that truly we hadn't done, like the vision of the movie for, like I said, like 45 years ago or whatever it was, I think is amazing. And once you put it in that context, I do think it's one of the strongest films in the first five, but there's something about Escape and Conquest that I really like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think we've kind of touched on this too, because that's the thing. Like, all these movies, they hit on something that's very personal to society, because that was the thing about Planet of the Apes, talking about some of the things that, or addressing some of the issues that they did at the time they were doing it. I remember when we went back and watched Conquest, and just like seeing like the either the Holocaust or the slave image. Like, I guess the guy who's really helping Caesar in Conquest is like a black man, and this is a movie made in like 1973, I believe. 72 for Conquest. So, I mean, I'm surprised this movie got made, or this movie was popular at all, or people weren't like rioting because of this movie. I don't know. Maybe that's, you know, but it makes me
it was apes, you know, it's a monkey movie. And yeah, so they're not paying attention to what the monkey movie is doing. They're just okay, good. They're making another monkey movie for us. Yeah. bring in the money.
Well, you that's know, what I think it, makes sci-fi so great. I was looking for like what's the purpose of sci-fi, because I've been actually in some conversations recently about like what makes really good sci-fi, and I found this thing that said science fiction and fantasy both answer the question what if. Science fiction takes our current understanding of how the universe works and imagines ideas and technologies that we haven't seen yet but still could fit within that understanding. And I think that's what I like about the Planet of the Apes franchise so much, because it takes these ideas and it says, if we keep going along this trajectory, this isn't how things are now, but, or you think you're so different from your past, but,
yeah.
What are there?
Yeah, you look in Dawn, and it's about two groups, and it says a lot about reconciliation and tribalism and ignorance. And if you were to make a movie about, let's say, the Palestinian and Israeli conflict, and you just made it about that, you're going to alienate so many people, whether you side with one group or not. But you make it sci-fi with apes, and you can get people thinking about reconciliation, about war, about violence in almost a non-confrontational way. And so that's what I really feel like, that's the power of science fiction. And it can really get us thinking in a way that maybe we're not used to.
No, I completely agree.
Yeah, and it gives you characters in these far out, interesting, wow, cool situations. But then you also are able to see it draws you in with the window dressing.
Yeah.
But then there's, in good sci-fi, there's just that deeper meaning, and that's why even Battle for the Planet of the Apes, there's stuff in there they tried, you know, it's not necessarily great stuff in there, but they were still trying to say, okay, what are we talking about here, and we have us versus them, and we have, you know, these themes when is it okay to kill. And it's interesting because basically Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is a remake of Battle for the Planet of the Apes, or feels like one to me.
There's a lot of similarities,
similar themes and similar actions and similar character beats and that kind of thing. But the other thing is, you know, remember Vietnam was going on there in those time, and you have this idea of the hawk, you know, you have the general, was it Urko in battle, or was it? I can't remember. I get the ape generals get all mixed up in my mind, but you know, he's just beating the war drums, man. You know, and it just you have the imagery too of putting the humans all in, you know, behind bars, and again you're getting back into that Holocaust imagery, and then you have Caesar, who, you know, we want to learn from our future, and he won't learn from the human's past, you know. Oh, the human's past is the human's past, not the apes. And so we need to go and find out what my parents had to say. And then you also have these family themes and stuff too. It's just, it tries to be rich. It tries to be deep. And it, you say B movie, you know, about the original, you know, you're getting way into getting deep into B here with Battle. Right?
Well, and that's the thing, because it seems by the time Battle comes along, it shouldn't be a B movie anymore. After Escape and Conquest, it shouldn't be B territory. We should have gotten more of the same, and we got made for TV movie, like you said.
Yeah, and I think that was a mandate. I think that was I couldn't tell you. It's been a while since I've read the making of books and stuff. I think that was a mandate of the producer saying, look, you made Conquest and that's great, but it's scary. You know? And there were people who, with the original ending of Conquest, they showed it in some urban areas and they loved it. And the original ending was, we're going to kill you, you know, and we are going to rule you. And you're seeing people get shot in the head and all this stuff. But then they take it to more, you know, of your rural areas and your suburban areas, and they're like, this is bad, because they studied footage from like the Watson I can't remember the name of the riots, but some of these race riots that were going on, and they were studying that footage and trying to ape that, and they really it's visceral and it's scary. And so they had Roddy McDowall come back in. They couldn't reshoot him, but they had him come in and do some voiceover. And so at the end, when he's giving his speech, you know, he's, we're going to rule you, we're going to kill you or whatever. And then, but wait, no, you know, and we're yeah. going to be benevolent rulers over you. And we're going to treat you with kindness as we enslave you. And just to soften the blow at the end. And they actually, mm-hmm. they're about to kill the president, and they ran the footage backwards of the gorillas with their gun butts that they were going to kill him with. They ran it backwards, so it was like they're stepping back and putting the guns down rather than lifting them up to go and kill him. So you know, they softened the blow big time in that movie. And because it was saying, like you said, I don't know how it got made. They were worried about some of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I just love the fact that that's the kind of power that film can have. I mean, for some of the things, you know, Wade said, you know, you can't actually show some of these, like, these analogies in real life. You know, you can't make a film, even documentaries nowadays, or even most times, if you try to make one that's just like, these things are happening right now in real life. Like, this conflict is happening, or these two people groups don't get along, so let's try to figure out why. When you make that movie, depending on who watches the movie, they'll assume that you're already trying to make a case for one side or another. Mm-hmm. Like, but mm-hmm. when you can actually step back and put it into like the sci-fi genre, it actually allows people oftentimes, if the metaphor or the analogy isn't too like on the nose, to kind of take a unbiased look at it and kind mm-hmm. of see what's going on. Yeah. Both you guys have already mentioned how this is, the battle kind of alludes to a lot of the things that we see in Dawn, so we can move to Dawn. And so I'll start with: did you guys enjoy Dawn? How did this new one strike you?
I liked it. Yes, yes. In answer to your question, yes, I did.
And you can expound on that.
I'll just jump to it. I'm not going to bury the lead. I think it's really interesting that a remake of one of the worst movies in the franchise ends up being one of the best movies in the franchise. I really like this movie.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect movie at all, and we can talk about that too. But it is really, really good and very strong and very emotional. And I'm watching it, and this is the best Pixar movie that Pixar never made. It's emotional, but the characters that are animated are the characters you're most emotionally tied to. The human characters, there's some emotion there. Don't get me wrong. There's some stuff going on there, but every single ape in both Rise and Dawn were animated. In Rise, there's what, a couple dozen? In Dawn, there's hundreds, you know, and when you get the close-ups and stuff, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is, I felt like when I first came home, I felt like this is the best movie of the year that I've seen. I don't know if I'd stick with that. I'd have to sit down and actually look at the other movies and and see. But it's definitely, it definitely had the most emotional resonance with me of any movie that I've seen this year. Captain America: Winter Soldier, I really liked, and I probably wound up watching that one more. But that's because I have a podcast about the Marvel Universe. And, but this is one that I definitely, I mean, I'll be rewatching this one.
Well, I think that says a lot with your history of Planet of the Apes. So, Wade, drop it on us.
Yeah, I like Ben, I enjoyed this movie. I really liked Rise, and it was really unexpected. When I saw the trailer for Rise, I was like, this movie is going to be terrible. Like, did they not learn their lesson? And then I watched it, and I was impressed. I was like, I didn't expect it. But what I think Dawn does is it takes the storyline, and I think it even has a little bit better of a storyline. But Rise was kind of weak in subtext. Some of the themes I didn't feel like were as deep in Rise or were just non-existent. And Dawn kind of gets back to the original franchise, and it has very deep things. And one of the ways I judge how good a film is if there's a lot to talk about. And if I'm thinking about a film, if I want to talk about a film, then I'm like, okay, there's something there. And I really like talking about this film. I enjoy it, and I really want to because there's a lot to talk about. And there's a lot of movies I haven't seen this year, so I can't say it's the best. I would say it's probably the best summer blockbuster. I'll probably watch X-Men: Days of Future Past more because I'm a big X-Men fan. I love those characters, but I think in terms of just movie summer blockbusters, this is probably the best one of the summer.
Can you believe this is a summer movie?
Yeah, that's kind of the weird thing.
It's really it's very different from a summer movie. And there's action, but the action is you know, it's, you got to wait for it. It's really interesting, and I very much enjoyed it.
Well, I'm probably, you know, going on my futuristic crystal ball. I feel like the movie that comes out this summer that I'm going to watch more than any other is probably going to be Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
Even though I haven't seen it yet.
Well, but that's the difference between Planet of the Apes and Escape from Planet of the Apes. Escape is a fun movie. Guardians of the Galaxy looks like it's going to be a very, very fun movie. And I like watching fun stuff, you know?
But that's the thing. Like, I was like, this is a great movie. And it's one of the best movies I've seen all year. I think, kind of like Ben alluded to, like, I really enjoyed, you know, Captain America. I personally really enjoyed Noah. So, I mean, like, those are movies that have really stuck with me, kind of for reasons Wade's also said, you know, there's tons of stuff to talk about. So I don't know if it's the best right now. I don't know if it will stay the best. But for what I expect from a summer blockbuster, this was way, way better. I was like, it gives me the budget, the action, the effects of a blockbuster, but it gave me the heart of a movie that I'm going to see, you know, like in the October to December time.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, this really found that balance, and it was incredibly enjoyable and incredibly astounding to see apes come to life in a way that didn't make me think that it was a dude in a plastic mask.
Oh yeah. I mean, the effects, imagine if the effects were bad in this film.
It would have fallen apart.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't have gotten nearly the emotional connection to any of the characters. Now, I mean, I was telling you earlier, the Burton movie, there's two good things about it. One is the makeup effects are really, really strong, and the other is the music. But I can't imagine, even with all the great makeup that they had in that movie, for them to try and do this one with that, where you have, you're looking at a dude. You still are looking at a person with longer legs and shorter arms. And, you know, with these guys, you know, they're riding a horse, and you're like, oh, that it looks a little awkward for them, you know, because their legs are so short. And there's just that attention to detail. And they open and close the movie with a close-up on his eyes.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. Mm-hmm. In a movie like this, that is dangerous. They could easily turn you off by doing that. But it doesn't, because there's life in those eyes. And I'm not sure how much they were able to keep from the actual image of Circus, you know, when he's doing the motion capture, and how much, you know, this is just, you know, computer graphics. But yeah, there's life there.
I think something that really helped me get into the movie was something that it didn't even touch on, those graphics that we were really impressed with. And that was, like, did you guys see the three little short films that they released?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am even more excited to see this movie now, because, I mean, it sets up lots of the themes I think we see in Dawn. It sets up, like, the basically the rise of that tribalism Wade was talking about earlier. And I don't get to see this very often. Like, you know, what kind of precedent have they set for giving us, you know, I feel like when we watch movies now, I watch a trailer, I watch trailer 2, I watch trailer 3, and then like a week before it comes out, I get like featurettes or, you know, like a 10-minute preview or something like that. The first 10 minutes, like we got a Captain America. But this was original, like three original short films, and they completely filled in a 10-year gap. Like, did it work for you guys as much as it did for me?
I'll say somewhat, and then after seeing the movie, I was really disappointed in some lost opportunities. Somewhat because, first of all, you don't see any apes at all, except for the eyes of one. And that's not a big deal, but this is only setting up the human side. And you're just seeing human civilization break down. That's the purpose of these three things, is to see human civilization break down. One of them, you're following a gun. And yeah, that's kind of interesting. But how much more interesting would it have been if that had been the exact gun that the dude had, that he had hidden in his case? You know, and so you follow that gun in that short movie, and then, oh, that's where that gun came from. You know, and then there's the family theme that you have in one of the other shorts. And it's just, well, wait a minute. Why can't we follow the family from the movie? You know, I understand what they're doing. And also there's budget things. That's why you don't have apes and stuff, but
we don't have Gary Oldman.
Right. Right. But you don't, don't follow Gary Oldman. You'll follow, follow Carrie Russell, but make her younger. You know, and so it's a different actress even or something. I don't know. But this is probably, I mean, they have the Marvel one-shots that they did that go, you know, on the Blu-ray exclusive kind of thing. And those are cool. They cost a lot of money, so they're not doing one for, I think it's Winter Soldier doesn't get one. And so, yeah, this is new and unusual. But I guess part of it is I'm used to reading prequel books and prequel comics and that kind of thing, where it actually is a prequel to the characters that you're getting in the movie. And that's not what these are. And they're not intended to be. And I also don't know how much connection the people making these movies had to, you know, the actual script. And then you're also paying for the usage of the characters. Whoever wrote the first screenplay for Rise, they're getting money for their characters being used in Dawn, you know? And so, you know, who knows what the behind the scenes was going on there, but yeah, I thought they were okay.
So because money.
Yeah.
I try my best not to watch trailer 3 and the featurettes or anything. Like for Guardians of the Galaxy, I think I've seen clips of the final trailer. I've seen the first one. But I try not to watch a lot of trailers because the trailers give so much away. And I didn't watch these prequels before the film. And so I tried to go in knowing the least amount possible. And when I watched them, I'm like, okay, it's cool. It doesn't really – I mean, it connects in some way, but it doesn't connect directly. So for me, it was all right. You know, it's interesting because I like the movie to watch them. But, you know, they were okay.
I just want to make sure I was on an island with really enjoying them. I appreciate that.
Hey, speaking of trailers giving it away, man, that battleship coming in to the
what is
the
this
San Francisco Bridge in the trailer for Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. They gave away that whole plot of the battleship.
Things
that
didn't exist.
I did, you know, I saw that afterwards that somebody did a still shot of that.
Yeah.
And then, but he decided to cut that sequence.
My understanding was that they actually, that shot was even just created for the trailer.
Okay.
And then, but originally the plan was, and I think that might have been in one of the links that you sent me even, Fizz, but they planned to end it with these battleships coming over the horizon and Caesar and all the other apes on the San Francisco Bridge watching and waiting for them to, you know, basically war is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they stopped when they did, which I think was a good choice.
Yeah, yeah.
You still had that idea.
Don't box yourself in.
Yeah.
You know, let there be other possibilities available. Yeah, I like that too.
Well, I was going to say, there is a link to that, and I will put that in the show notes and stuff, because I like the reason that the director gave that they didn't end the film that way was because they really wanted you to sit with the weight of, like, the decision that Caesar had made at the end of the film, or the community he basically built, and the oncoming war, and, you know, still ending on his eyes, just like the film started with. And I agree that that was probably a much better way to end the film. If they would have started the next one, I mean, I'm already interested in what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
I don't need to see boats coming down or coming into San Francisco Harbor or anything like that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that definitely, it paints you in, because now, yeah, war is coming, but it could come in many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And with that ending, it's just like, okay, yeah, that's the way it's coming. It's coming on a boat.
Yeah.
Well, was that frustrating to anyone else? Or, I mean, not like really frustrating about the movie, because we obviously enjoyed it, but like the fact that it seemed like Caesar was fighting and fighting and fighting, figuratively, mostly, through this movie to keep peace, and no matter what he did, it seemed futile.
Yeah, he had a lot of antagonism coming from the script, basically. It's the script was going to bring it no matter what.
Yeah. And,
but that's this is a tragedy. You know, we are watching and we know this is not going to go well. In fact, the whole time I'm watching the movie, whenever something good would happen, I'd be like, oh, this is just getting worse and worse. Like, the good stuff is happening. I'm just feeling worse and worse because I know it's not going to go well.
I felt the same way. Like, you know it's coming. And so that was, I don't know if I would say that's a weakness to the film. You know it's coming. You just don't know how. And there's that scene where Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell have Caesar's son, and, you know, they're playing with him, and it's such a beautiful scene. But I'm like, I know something's coming. Like, this, it's not. And then boom, there's the shotgun, right? And so that, yeah, it was that was a tough thing, but it also produced a lot of tension that I felt like was good.
Well, and then the scene where they get the power on.
Oh yeah,
and they're all laughing and dancing and happy, and I'm just, oh, this is not gonna last. This is not gonna last.
Yeah.
It's gonna go bad. And everything good that's happening is just, it creates a bigger downfall for when the bad comes. And
yeah, because you can see the beauty of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. You can see the beauty of two groups working together. It's possible. And it makes it even more of a tragedy, a Shakespearean tragedy, in a sense. You know, you have Caesar, you have Koba, who's kind of like a Brutus character. You have that going on, and it makes it all just so much of a tragedy, because you can see it. It's there, but it just doesn't last.
Yeah, and I'll say also, my big problem with the movie is that it is predictable. There is a lot of predictable stuff in this movie, and you can connect the dots fairly easily and fairly early on. It's, you could almost call it Chekhov's gun on the Planet of the Apes, because they hang guns all over the place on the wall in the first act. They're going to be taken off and used on the third act. Mm-hmm. And so you just know, okay, she's sick. She's a doctor. Okay. We know where that's going. That's going to be a bargaining chip for, you know, reconciliation. And sure enough, that's where it went. You know, as soon as I saw Cornelia was sick, I knew that that's what was going to happen. The humans are going to help her to get well. before I even knew what the tension was going to be there. And so there is that problem with the movie as far as the plotting and stuff like that. But it adds to the tragedy in other ways, because I care about the characters. And so as I'm watching things happening and realizing, and that's the thing, is I cared about Caesar. I didn't care about Cornelia other than Caesar did. And I cared about Caesar.
Yeah. Because of Caesar. Yeah.
I cared about Koba. Honestly. I mean, you could, you know, let the, Caesar says, let the humans go do their work, you know, and Koba says, this human work, you know, pointing at his scars, and you can see, okay,
well, yeah,
how could he trust a human if they did that to him? He can't. And you know, and from the first movie, he's the one you were scared of anyway. He was a freaky ape, man.
Oh yeah.
But
just because he looks a little beat up,
right? Well, he's ugly because he was destroyed by humanity. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, he's ugly and evil. But the ugliness comes from what we did to him, we being humans. And so for his hatred and his evil ugliness to, you know, it was done to him by humans. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes that tragedy, because you know, at the beginning of the movie almost, okay, they're friends, but they don't agree on everything. But Koba's friends with him. And then slowly Koba turns against him. And you brought up Noah. Mm-hmm. Koba turning Caesar's son against him. Turning, was it Blue Eyes? Not Bright Eyes, but Blue Eyes. So much better than Noah's son getting turned against him in that movie. It actually worked. And I never believed it in Noah. And that's a big downfall. Honestly, that would be a huge fix. If they had done that in such a way that I believed it, I would have been much more forgiving of that movie. But
he used his love for his father to turn him against him.
Exactly.
And that was so – Koba's so smart. And oh, you don't like him, but you do like him. That he uses his father's love to say, hey, if you want to protect your father, you're going to have to side with me. And that was realistic.
Yeah, your father can't protect himself.
Yeah.
I'm your father's friend. We both love your father, you know.
Ugh. And I loved the use of technology in this film. I feel like they're trying to – there's a lot going on with technology. And you see that a little bit with the atomic bomb in Beneath, the power of technology, humans using technology to destroy themselves. And so if you look at the series in Rise, you know, it was technology that started – the simian flu, it started everything to begin with. If you look at the reason that the apes and humans meet is because they're going after technology. They're going after the dam, electricity. And then you have the guns. The guns come in, and that really pulls them apart. And it's almost as if they're saying technology can be good. We see it in the scenes with the music at the gas station.
Yeah.
We see it with Gary Oldman's character. He's able to see his family for the first time because his, you know, with his iPad, he's able to look at their picture. You know, technology is good, but in the wrong hands, it pulls apart the human depravity, and it just kind of escalates that. And so I love what they were doing. They're kind of hitting some of those themes, and that really piqued my interest. It really did.
Well, and the other thing is the just reliance on technology. Going back to oh, what's his name? Who is the guy you were just talking about?
Gary Oldman. Dreyfuss?
Yeah, Gary Oldman.
He had glasses.
He had glasses. Mm-hmm. And think about that. That's such a simple thing. It's not even necessarily considered technology. Although I've heard some people consider, you know, anyone who wears glasses, they're using technology to augment themselves, and so they can be considered a cyborg. He's wearing glasses, and without those glasses, he's going to have weaker vision and not be as strong of a person. And so, yeah, his struggle is we have to keep the power on.
Oh, yeah.
We can't live like them, you know, and it's scary when you think about how much we rely on gas, how much we rely on technology, and to have it all, you know, in the zombie apocalypse or the ape uprising, you know, whichever is going to happen. you know, we need that technology, and it's so it's a precarious thing that we're hanging on to.
What was interesting to me when you talk about getting the power on and stuff, the thing that kept popping up is like, I was really surprised that everyone was like, oh, we want to, things to go back to the way they were, the way they were, the way they were. I would have assumed, because I feel like in most dystopian things, they're all like going on, what's the best thing for us to continue surviving? And I think if I was like, why aren't they using their means to like learn how to farm and self-sustain instead of like trying to go get the power back on so they can look at their iPads? You know, is there really like this concept that they can do that? I mean, maybe
my guess is that's off screen. You know, they have that one area that's kind of their city, mm-hmm. but the weapons aren't behind that wall.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that in the parks or something like that, they have some agrarian stuff going on.
They have to survive. I mean, to be able to survive as long as they did.
Because canned food, you know, despite what science fiction movies may tell us, doesn't necessarily last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, they might be able to still eat those Twinkies and Spam, but the, you know, canned corn and stuff like that, they're not going to work as well. So I think that that's where this is such a big world, and it's populated by a lot of people and a lot of apes, too. But I do think that there was some of that going on off screen.
Yeah.
We just have to trust on that one.
Yeah. And it's kind of cool that they don't give us all the answers. And if you look back to Star Wars and George Lucas, he kind of just – he drops you into this world. And that's what makes it cool because, you know, it's a fully functioning world. We don't know how some things came about, but we just know that it's there. And I do like this. Matt Reeves builds such a good world. And we don't know, we don't have all the answers, but we can kind of guess and say, okay, this is probably how it's working. This is probably what's going on. It adds a little bit of mystery to it.
No, I'd agree with that. I think one of the best things that he does is we already kind of know what, I guess, a human world should look like. And so we don't have to spend time going over that. And since we stick with Caesar the entire movie, well, most of the entire movie, we basically get to... He gets to build an ape society for us.
Yeah.
In an ape society that doesn't reflect really what we saw in the original ape movies. We see an ape society that's learning how to do it on its own. It's not just basically like people, apes doing all the same things humans are. We see in the original Planet of the Apes movies. But the ironic thing to me is that they still start along the same path. You still, no matter how good you try to make your society, you're always going to have people who err on the side of self-preservation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the big theme, is ape shall not kill ape. And then, mm-hmm. you not ape.
And one of the things that, you know, I kind of look at every film and say, okay, is this trying to tell us something that relates to... a Christian worldview, or you know, relates in some way to our, you know, how we view the world as followers of Jesus. And I really see total depravity, you know, kind of center stage here, because you have the apes and they are almost in a Garden of Eden. I mean, they're there, they have their own society, there's peace, and you still see the seeds of selfishness and greed and the lust for power. It's there, and it's a really interesting illustration of depravity. And you see that, you know, from the very beginning. They don't need technology, they don't need that, but yet those seeds, you know, the seeds of depravity are still there. And I think it's a very interesting look at the world, and that really stuck out to me as I watched the film.
No, I'd say something very similar, because, I mean, I read some things. None of the things I linked for you guys to kind of review before the show, but there were people whose gripes about the film were, this film is like anti-capitalism or anti-technology or anti, you know, growth in industry. And I thought the film, kind of like I feel we've already pointed out, isn't really anti those things. It's showing that they can be used for good or bad.
Yeah.
And the things that make us use those things for good or bad are even there in the ape society. And lots of times, those the things that make those items or those, you know, concepts bad are people who think they're still doing good. I think that's why Koba ends up being such a compelling, like, bad guy, because even though he's manipulative and stuff, I don't think he sees himself as the bad guy. You know, mm-hmm. he thinks he's Not the, he's all, the one yeah. who really knows what's going on mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. trying to save apes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that, I think, you know, and Gary Oldman, who, you know, I don't think is on the level of Koba, but still, you know, he's like, we've survived this long. We're going to find a way to keep surviving. You know, he doesn't think he's the bad guy. He thinks he's the hero.
Oh, and I think that's, and it's hard to blame him. He's ignorant. I don't think he's bad. I mean, he risks his life because he feels like to do that will save the human race. And so the lines in this film between good and bad, they're just kind of blurred. The humans aren't all good. The apes aren't all good, but neither are all of them bad. And it says a lot about tribalism. It says a lot about conflict in our world. It's not that – I mean, most of the time, it's not that, hey, they're good and they are the bad guys in these conflicts. It's – there's a lot of misunderstanding, and there's good in both camps, and there's also evil in both camps. And I really liked that tension. The movie doesn't really pick a side. It does center more on the apes, but it doesn't pick a side and say, hey, this side is good and this side is bad. And that made it compelling for me.
Yeah, you say it focuses on the apes. I felt like in some ways at the beginning I was watching a documentary. Or maybe a better way to describe it, I was watching an ape movie. I was watching a foreign film that was made by apes, but they subtitled
That's
it
so
for
racist.
Me. You know, they did it in ape language.
Yeah.
You know, they mm-hmm. had the ape sign language and the grunting and that kind of thing, but they gave us the subtitles.
Yeah.
And so I was watching, you know, it was a foreign film made by apes. But the other thing is with, you know, talking about the both sides, there was definitely a mirror here. We had on the human side and on the ape side characters in similar roles. So you had Dreyfus and Koba,
yeah.
who are both Dreyfus wasn't necessarily a warmonger. But he was, we are going to use weapons and we are going to survive. And Koba was doing the same kind of thing. And, you know, you had the wives on both sides and both of our male protagonists on both sides. You had Caesar. And again, like I said, the ape characters are the characters you focused on. I can't remember the name of the human.
Malcolm.
Yeah. You have Malcolm and Caesar on either side with each other. And Malcolm and Caesar both have sons. And so you have this kind of mirror hanging up between the two of them. And that brings me back to what you were kind of saying with the animals and the humans. It's basically these animals were becoming more human. And the apes, they are animals. That's the thing to remember is as they are acting through the movie, they're doing animalistic things. And they are... you know, yeah, they live in a Garden of Eden, but they are there's that animal hierarchy, you know, where we will fight to see who leads. Apes always look for the strongest branch to mm-hmm. you know to hide on or whatever, and so it's might makes right in ape society there. Mm-hmm. Even though Caesar has morality, some of the other apes are still kind of stuck in their animal ways. And this, I think this is a movie that does explore a little bit. I don't know how well it does, but it explores a little bit the difference of, you know, what makes humans humans. Mm. And these apes are becoming more human, which brings us to that last line. You are not an ape. I, you know, can justify letting you die or causing you to die in this case. In Battle for the Planet of the Apes, we don't know if Caesar wanted, you know, to kill the gorilla, but the gorilla died anyway because he fell out of the tree. But with this one, you know, the justification is you are, you know, you're becoming human and you're acting more like a human, so I'm gonna let you die.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like the apes were the humans before technology, you know, thousands mm-hmm. of years ago. And we see, you know, a lot of times we look back at our history and we say, man, we humans were barbarians, right? If we can only have enough technology, medical, you know, psychology, we can cure evil in a sense. We can distinguish evil. But we look and we realize that this technology just it brings out the evil. And we, you know, the 20th century is like the bloodiest century ever. And the reason is because the technology, not that men are more evil than they were, it's that they have more means to their evil. And there's a lot of that going on, I feel like, in this film, you know, wrestling back and forth between where we were and where we are today.
And notice the apes had technology. They had fire.
Mm-hmm.
And they used spears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was very primitive technology, but this is technology that they're using. They have that spark of sentience, you know, of intelligence, of a soul or whatever you want to say, mm-hmm. That's been given to them by the simian flu stuff that was sprayed in the ape house there. But they have technology now, and it's how they're using it. It goes back to what you were saying, Fizz, with how they use it.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that in their desire to not be like humans or to be better than humans, because they're afraid, or well, they're not afraid, I guess, they're in total rejection of human culture, they actually are more controlled by human culture in their actions. So like, humans did this, we can never do this. Or
yeah.
I mean, like, or human, you know, this is what a bad human would do, so we'll never ever do that. And so they don't ever take the time to redeem any human actions, which is just lots of them are neutral actions in themselves, but the person behind it has their intention. And because they can't see behind the intention of the person, they're never gonna really evolve beyond being controlled by their fear and hatred of human beings. Like I said, and I feel like that's that reflection of humanity. You know, sometimes we'll see someone do something and we'll say, well, I dislike that person or whatever, so I will never do what they do. And we've already lost, because it's not the action that they did necessarily that we're judging. We're judging the intent of their heart, and where it actually controls us more, because it limits what we can do or our potential. That's the thing that I don't think we would see unless we had this kind of, you know, if we saw this in documentary form, like Wade mentioned, like way at the beginning, I think we would miss, or we would not be open to, but we see it played out between humans and apes in a sci-fi movie. And suddenly it's like, oh, that's a really good point.
And we see too, this, you know, the sway of just following your own leader, and the monkeys that just follow Koba. He's like, hey, we're going to march on the humans. All right, you know, where's my machine gun? And then as Caesar comes back and they start following him again. And kind of the mob mentality, the sway of the leadership. And I thought that was kind of an interesting picture there of that. And I like that part. You know, it takes a couple of strong leaders to move lots of people.
Mm-hmm. Because it was pretty interesting to see how, in general, the ape society was pretty unified under Caesar, pretty happy, you know, content, growing, learning, getting better. And all it did was it took one person. It took Koba.
But it took Koba using the death of Caesar. You know, he like he did with Bright Eyes or Blue Eyes. Help me out here. I'm trying to help your father. It was, they killed Caesar. Mm-hmm. We kill them. You know, let's go. And oh, now they're burning our house down, too. You know,
what was interesting to see the two kids, kind of their juxtaposition, because it took Blue Eyes a lot longer to come around. But both of them eventually, both Alexander, I believe that was the kid's name, You know, he draws a picture at the beginning of the movie of like Caesar on the horse, like yelling and like a scary monster version of Caesar. And it's not until they actually take time to live with him or see the other side. And this is that tribalism stuff that, you know, that Wade, I think you're like, you're spot on. Like, once you get to know a person or once you see how the other side lives and you can humanize, which is the irony in this movie, you know, apes being human, more human at times than humans. Once you can humanize that other person, you can see past their actions. And then, you know, Alexander comes back and draws this picture of Caesar much later in the film that's like much more reflective of to who Caesar actually is once he realizes he's strong and smart and caring. And just like, you know, it takes both the sons a while to get to that point because of the environment they grew up in.
And man, did they do a great job in this film of painting those characters? Like, just phenomenal. Whenever things start happening, whenever they start going after the humans, my immediate thought was, okay, where's Maurice? Where's Rocket? Where's Ash? Those kind of loyal apes. I'm like, well, you know, what are they doing? Who are they siding with? You're kind of looking out for them. You start to care about these characters, and they do a really good job of painting that picture.
And when Ash is killed, you know, and the thing with that all of this reminds me of Shakespeare. Well, I shouldn't say all of it. A lot of it reminds me of Shakespeare, and it reminds me of a scene in King Lear where one of the servants won't poke out the eyes, you know, and he stands against it, and that's okay. Well, you're done. You're out of here. You know, it's over for you. And that's Ash. Ash looks at what Koba is asking them to do and realizes, oh wait. I am really wrong right now. I should not be following this guy. And that death is tragic. It's just so quick too. But that's what pushes Blue Eyes. You know, that's what pushes Blue Eyes to say, oh, whoa, wait, this is not good. This is not good at all. And it's just, the characters take me, and I was empathizing with them and sympathizing, and I had not had a movie this year hit me emotionally the way this one did, because I was right there with those computer generated apes, and it was an emotional movie.
And I love the way that Matt Reeves ended it, and I'm glad he ended it the way he did, because it just sticks with you. Just the ending just sticks with you, and you care about the humans, but you also care about the apes. It's a really powerful ending.
But what is it saying that the apes are going to live there? I mean, that's where they seem to be staying. Humans, go. You must leave. The other humans are coming here. War is coming here. It can't be stopped. You have to go. We'll be here. And it feels like that they're, you know, we're going to stay in the city.
I felt like, I guess I felt like maybe he was saying like, get out of the area. I didn't feel like he was saying get out of like just this area of San Francisco, but like get out of this part of the country, because war's going to hit, you know, the forest, war's going to hit this whole region. So I guess, I don't know.
And they've got the guns now too.
Yeah. And the tank, oh, that tank shot, that was very fantastic. The whole cinematography of this film helped you just kind of get into the perspective of the apes, and that tank shot, it did it for me.
I was worried. When he pulled the guy out of the tank, I was worried he was going to start driving it. And I'm like, oh. And okay, I can accept that it's just going to keep spinning around, he'll keep shooting, and it's just going to keep going in the direction it's going. Okay. Whew, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
almost took me out.
When Koba was wielding the machine guns on the horse and he jumped through the flame, I kind of grinned a little bit on that. I'm going to be honest. That
was like machine gun.
Yeah. The dual machine guns on the horse and he hopping through the flame. That was pretty great though. I did enjoy that part, but I did smile. I did smile a bit.
It looked like it should have been one of those memes on Facebook that says, like, this is the greatest thing you'll see on the internet today or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Your argument is invalid, you know.
An ape riding a horse through fire with two machine guns.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we are, unfortunately, about that time where we need to start wrapping up. Actually, past time when we need to start wrapping up.
Can I share one thing with you?
You can share lots of things.
That's really fine. Quick. Okay, so I think this is hilarious. Have any of you seen the original score soundtrack at all? The
like
names
the
of the tracks? Yeah.
No, I haven't.
They are all puns. It is fantastic.
Yeah, that's so, Michael Giacchino.
Yes.
However you say his name. He does that in every soundtrack. Yeah.
So this one is, I'll name a couple of them, The Apes of Wrath, Close Encounters of the Furred Kind. Oh, let's see. Monkey See, Monkey Coop. I thought that was just hilarious. I just thought that was so, you know, it was really funny. But so we can go on. We can move on now.
Yeah. Well, go ahead and look at his Star Trek ones, too. Because he scored Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, and he does that there. And, yeah, some of them are really bad, but he's a fantastic score guy. And the cool thing about this soundtrack was he does reference, I think anyway, he references some of the older soundtracks with from Jerry Goldsmith in like Planet of the Apes. And
yeah, I thought it was fun. I got a really big kick out of looking at the soundtrack.
Want to see that works out really well, because depending on how you feel about puns, it works right into how we start to wind down the show, which is to do your come on moment and your favorite moment. And so depending on where you land on that spectrum, that could have been someone's worst, you know, worst moment and favorite moment at the same time.
That's true. That's true.
So hit, you know, Wade, what was your come on moment about this film?
So come on. Okay. I liked Jason Clarke's character, Malcolm, but I look at Jason Clarke and I saw what he did in Zero Dark Thirty, and I've seen some of his work, and I was like, there could have been something more. Like, I felt like his character was a little underdeveloped, that maybe there was something more that they could have done with him. And I realize he's not the main character. Mm-hmm. You know, Caesar,
and that might have been
is
the biggest problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say he's an incredible talent, and so are, you know, Gary Oldman as well. And I felt like there was more that they could have done with them. So I guess you could say that was my come on moment.
All right, Ben.
It's hard. I've got two for each.
That's fine. That's
okay.
Fine.
Come on, number one was Caesar falling. I knew he wasn't going to die, and okay, so he falls, and falls a long way, and I'm just, okay. But then, after all the apes have left, the humans come back and just happen to find him as they're running around trying to not get noticed by apes.
Seems legit.
Ah, come on. And my second one is Caesar can barely climb the ladder to get to the top of the building, but then he's able to have a knockdown drag out with Koba. That,
you
let's
just,
be
you
honest.
So, you just don't understand ape adrenaline.
It, maybe that's it. Maybe that's
yeah,
it. But as I was watching it, I was feeling like he carried the fight too much. I was expecting Maurice to get a little more involved, maybe, or Blue Eyes to get more involved. But just the way he was able to sustain the fight, even though, I mean, he is still, like they said, you know, you can't do this, and he can barely walk to the car, and then he's able to climb the ladder up the entire building and then do the fight. Come on.
I just expect a little more Blue Eyes in there,
at least, because Blue Eyes character arc is done at that point, and it shouldn't have been, because Blue Eyes and Koba had a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And there should have been more of a I'm following you, or maybe showing Koba, I'm not following you. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking of character arcs that just disappeared, all the humans, except for Malcolm, just disappeared.
Yeah. Bye.
Yeah. Well, okay, so my favorite moments, though, it's either the eyes at the beginning and the end. I love that frame. That's just wonderful. And so there's energy behind those eyes, even though they're not really doing much, and there's humanity in those eyes. And or fighting the bear. I mean, anytime anyone has to fight the bear, it's just – it makes it better. And so, yeah, the bear fight was just – it was brutal and quick and not choreographed and cool. I loved that bear fight. So,
well, it works. What were your favorite moments, Wade?
There are a lot. I mean, there are a lot of a lot of them. I really enjoyed, if I had to narrow it down to like one or, you know, one or two, I really enjoyed how they referenced back to Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and they showed why Caesar is, you know, gives the humans so many chances, and why he has compassion and why he sees the good in them. It's because he was raised by someone who was good, and he sees the good that was in James Franco's character. He sees it in Malcolm. And there was just so much there, because it goes along with reconciliation and war and violence and peace, that really the answer to that is getting to know your enemy, you know, walking a mile in their shoes, and you realize the humanity that you often didn't realize before. And so I would say, you know, those moments I felt like were well done. And then, you know, I know, you know, Ben, you kind of harped on a little bit, but I was waiting for Koba and Caesar to square off, like Caesar to make his big return and just like duke it out. Like, I was looking forward to that moment. And so that was a good moment for me.
Hmm. You brought up something. Sorry. Can I take us off track just a little bit
here?
Make it happen. You bring up Koba. You bring up rather a Caesar and why he sees the good in humanity. Consider upbringing here, though. Consider nature versus nurture with Koba and Caesar, where you have Caesar, who had a guy who actually loved him, raising him. And then you have Koba, who has people experimenting on him and cutting him and giving him scars and giving him, you know, this terrible, terrible treatment. And then how do they respond later in life? Caesar is, I will give you more chances. I will tentatively trust you, you know, and Koba is just, these people are bad. Look what they did to me. And it does kind of bring up some ideas of nature versus nurture that I hadn't thought of until you just mentioned that.
Yeah, those are good thoughts, Ben. Yeah, those are good thoughts that you mentioned right there. It does, nature versus nurture. And that's why I love this film, because there's so much to talk about.
There is.
Yeah.
And I thought of one more. Oh, come on.
One more good one?
Can I do that or not?
Nope.
Just one more. Okay. The end credits. End credits of Rise of the Planet of the Apes were so wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Because you saw the spreading of the virus, and it was just so interesting. And then the opening credits of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes did the same kind of thing, but you're basically watching the power go out across the globe. And it's interesting the way they did it. And then you get to the end credits of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and I'm waiting. Something interesting. No, nope, it's just rolling credits, just and you hear apes in the background.
Yeah.
At the very end. And that's I just was expecting something a little more artful and a little more interesting, and I didn't get it.
Maybe that's so maybe it's a metaphor for the darkness that's coming.
Yes. Or the darkness has already come. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
But so he kind of dug his own grave by raising the bar so high.
It's just a wonderful film, though. And any problems I have are so minor when it really comes to how I feel about the movie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I feel the same way. Yeah,
I was going to say, Wade, you mentioned the fight between Caesar and Koba as like one of the things that you were waiting for. And I wasn't waiting for it, but their fight at the dam, I think that entire sequence at the dam for me probably was the weight of the film, because you know, they do have to, you know, Caesar, they do have to have like the strongest ape, that has to come to fruition. But Caesar also, you know, he forgives Koba again. You know, that wasn't the first time. And he knows that his actions will likely have consequences down the road.
Yeah.
And he does it anyway, because the chance of peace is so tempting that he's willing to... I can't imagine he's not smart enough to know that he's not putting his own life at risk by allowing Koba to continue, but not sacrificing those ideals. Yeah. And, you know, because in that same scene, that's when you get Koba saying, you know, like, you know, human work, human work, human work. So, you know, we're connecting with Koba, but we're siding with Caesar still. So that whole... Between that and the fact that, like, unlike all the other Planet of the Apes movies, all the apes didn't talk the whole time, gave this film a weight that, yeah, I do, you know, it was really powerful and it was really great. So with that said, I think there's one last question before I let you guys again plug everything that you're into, and that's, what's the next one going to be titled? Because I feel like we're running out of prepositional phrases.
Is it? Do you think it's War? Do you think it's War of the Planet of the Apes?
I think so. I think here's what we're looking at. I think we're looking at War on the Planet of the Apes. War over the Planet of the
Or War Apes. War for the Planet of the Apes?
Maybe War for. But then that's so similar to Battle for. I don't
and
know.
War for sounds so silly. War for.
Yeah, you know, it does.
I think that, because here's where I'm looking at, you said, I want to see what's going to happen next. Me too. What's going to happen next? And you remember in Rise, they mentioned the Icarus ship that was launched.
They did a little Easter egg. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more than just an Easter egg, because Ape, the takeover and downfall of the world has happened so quickly. They don't have to do the 2,000-year time warp, you know, faster than light thing for Icarus to come back and, oh, the apes are in control. The apes could, I mean, I think we could look at this next movie or the movie after that. Maybe the next movie is the War for, and you have like a huge battle. Mm-hmm. And it's apes connecting with other apes around the world or something. I don't know how that works. We don't know how big that is. You have humans, you know, rising up against the apes and everything like that. And so maybe at the end of that movie, apes are in control, and maybe Caesar has become Caesar. You know, he's the ruler. He's going to be, you know, like Caesar in battle, where he's like, we are going to rule now. Your time is over. And then the next movie, the Icarus comes back.
The time travel seems so out of place in this series.
No, there's
though.
No time travel though. There's no time travel. The Icarus is just gone. It launched. It went and did its mission, and now it's coming back, and it was a 10-year or a 15-year mission.
Oh, that's right.
I think that that's what we're looking at. I mean, I don't know exactly what there are no details. Mm-hmm. The 10-year, 15-year mission that I just said, that's not a detail. That's just something that they would write into it, because mm-hmm. all we know is that it launched and it went up. It can come back, and it doesn't have to do the time travel stuff. That's what I'm saying, is when the Icarus comes back, humanity is gone. Almost already,
yeah,
in this movie.
I get it.
So
yeah.
Icarus coming back in this movie, and they're coming back to a madhouse, you know? And yeah. So I think we're looking at, in either the next movie or the one after, we're looking at a Taylor story. Hmm. It won't be Charlton Heston, but I think we're looking at a Taylor coming to Earth and having to figure out how to survive.
Because they can't just have an all-out war. They've got to have an intimate story to make it compelling. And if you have a...
And the series that they've created so far.
Yeah. So it can't just be this whole battle scene. There's got to be a human figure. There's got to be this... You know, there's got to be an intimate story involved.
Yeah. And so and there will be. It'll be Caesar's story. That's the other thing is, no matter what...
It's got to continue. Yeah, it's got to continue to be Caesar's story.
This next movie is a Caesar story. Mm-hmm. And it might be him handing off, you know, to Blue Eyes or something like that. I don't know. But, man, I'm excited to see what they have planned, because this was really, really good. And it was better than Rise. And yeah, but I think we're looking at Taylor coming back here in a movie or two.
And I'm a big fan of Matt Reeves. I like Cloverfield. I like Let Me In. I'm really pumped about this, you know, what he did with this film, and then he signed on to direct the next one. So I have a lot of hope for it. I don't think it's just going to be a madhouse. It's just going to be all at war. There's going to be some sort of story. I just don't know how, but I like the Icarus. That could be a very compelling story. And I didn't think about it, but it doesn't have to do time travel because it's, you know, a 15-year mission. And they get back.
If you think about it, what an interesting story of them going away and being cut off. The lights went out. You know, there's no connection back to humanity. They're coming back. They don't know what they're coming back to.
Yeah.
And it's a little different because they're coming back to Earth, not knowing what they're coming back to. But then they come back and there's Caesar and his, you know, the humans have been subjugated because they just can't stop going to war. Mm. I don't know, but there's a lot of potential. A lot.
I just feel like a Taylor story is going to be another little short film. Like they're gonna come back, land, get out of the pod, get the simian flu, and die in a week.
That could be. But I mean, that also could be the way they kill off his crew.
Well, I was going to say, he could be the lone survivor because of that. Because outside of that, I mean, that was one of the things I thought they made a point of in the first Planet of the Apes films. Like, there was a virus and it killed like all the cats and dogs. Cats and
dogs,
you know, like it didn't affect the humans.
In Conquest, so, they have that statue of the cat and the dog in memorial for Spot.
I know, but it's okay because Ricardo Montalban is talking about the memorial, so I'm very interested in it.
Yeah, anything he says, you're paying attention. He's
like, you must understand, Caesar. So like, yes. Tell me more about it.
Ridiculous.
Tell me more about it, Ricardo. What about? Well,
but then you get into the time travel stuff, and you think about it. I don't want to. I'm derailing things even further.
I say, oh no. Okay, part two.
No, Cornelius and his wife, they brought the dog and cat flu virus back, so it happened earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones. They were carriers. Oh. Anyway, okay, sorry.
Nope. I love the paradoxes of the first movie. I think it's great. That whole... Because you have to, like... Well, like I said, we won't get into this time travel.
There's a big conversation about time travel in this whole franchise, yeah.
I've really enjoyed this, and it's been awesome to have both you guys here. So I'm sure all the other people out there who have... and now enjoy this as well, want to know how they can follow more things that you do. Now that both of you guys are super podcasters, let people know how to get a hold of your podcasts that you're on, anywhere else they can find you on the web. And Wade, just because I thought of your name first for whatever reason. Go ahead.
You can follow me at wadebearden.com. It's my personal blog, but I link to almost all the articles that I do. And so I do a lot of different stuff. I do a lot of movie reviews. So you can find all that stuff there. You can follow me on Twitter at Wade Hans. And if you don't know how to spell Hans, it's my middle name. It'll be, you know, in the show notes. But you can follow me there. And then check out ChristInPopCulture.com. I'm on the Friday podcast. And all, you know, the podcast is really cool for staying up to date on just issues. And then thinking about, okay, how this relate to the Christian worldview. And so you can subscribe to Christ and Pop Culture through iTunes. Check out the website, and I'd love to connect with you.
Awesome. Mr. Ben.
Well, you can find me at benavery.com, where I wish I was doing some of the things that Wade has done with his website, because I'd like to link to all the stuff I'm doing. It's a really bad website right now, but that's my personal website where you can buy my books, and you can there's links to my podcast, but my comic books are on there and stuff like that. You can also listen to me at strangersandaliens.com, where we talk about science fiction and fantasy and Christianity and faith and pop culture and all that kind of thing. You can also find me at welcometolevel7.com, where I talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the I'm just going to say it. This is a new one. It's going to be out by the time this drops, I hope. When are you dropping this? Fizz?
Hypothetically tomorrow, but it's almost midnight now, so it might be Tuesday instead.
Okay, all right. Well, comicbooktimemachine.com. It's a comic book podcast with Daniel Butcher, Matt Anderson, and me. And we're launching this week with it. So
nice.
All right.
Heard it here first, maybe.
Yeah, we've hinted to it in other places, but yeah, this is the first time I've actually said, yeah, go to this website. So,
well, Comic Book Time Machine. I'll have all that in the show notes. And to get those show notes, you can go to realworldtheology.com, R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, which you've probably already been to because you're downloading the show. So thanks for coming, and thanks for listening to the episode. And if you want to keep the discussion going, please follow at RealWorldTheo on Twitter, or you can follow me at Fizzification. If you do want to know more about Real World Theology, you can go to the website. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, tell your family, tell everybody. I don't know why I became moderately Jewish, but that just happened. So again, I want to thank Ben Avery. I want to thank Wade Bearden for being here, guys. Thanks so much.
Hey, it is awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Because like I said, I didn't review this on my podcast. So yeah, StrangersAliens.com/Planet of the Apes. I mentioned, you know, this is what I'm doing. I'm not even going to do our own Dawn of the Planet of the Apes episode because.
But we had so many tangents. You probably could. That's the thing, man. Like, oh gosh, I feel like we still only scratched the surface. But since we do have to end these eventually, I guess this is where we will stop. So, thanks listeners for joining us. Thanks for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Hey, see you guys.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.